From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, the Baylor University sexual assault scandal.
It's just really a story about what happens when people in power ignore those in pain.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. At Baylor University, it's been reported that since 2011, 17 female students reported sexual or domestic assault charges against 19 Baylor football players. The scandals captured national headlines, resulting in Baylor firing their football coach Art Briles in May 2016. That next month, university president Ken Starr resigned. The story of Baylor's failures to protect its students is told in a new book by ESPN reporter Paula Levine and Mark Schlabaugh. The book is Violated, Exposing Rape at Baylor University Amid College Football's Sexual Assault Crisis. I asked the co-authors about the former Baylor coach Briles, who was recently hired to work in Canadian professional football.
I'm surprised, but I'm not surprised. I did not think he would be able to get another job in college football, just because I didn't think there was a university president or an athletics director that would be willing to give him a chance. I figured he might end up in the NFL as an assistant coach. CFL, Canadian Football League, makes more sense. We've seen in the past that that's where a lot of guys who run into trouble in the NFL end up north of the border playing football. June Jones, the former Southern Methodist coach, has just been named the head coach for the Hamilton Tiger Cat, so it kind of makes sense.
So Art Briles left Baylor University, a much celebrated coach, but also in disgrace, after it was alleged that he covered up for misdeeds of his players.
Well, I think it's certainly fair to say that he left amid great controversy. He was in charge of a program under which there were multiple student-athletes accused of raping or physically abusing women. Two of them were convicted. Others are awaiting trial. Others have never been gone farther than a police report or an allegation in a school investigation, but the numbers are pretty staggering. And the call for him to have taken action sooner, I think a lot of people felt like he was somewhat remiss in not addressing this as soon as the first allegations came out. There has not been a smoking gun, per se, in terms of Art Briles covering up a specific allegation of rape, but there were text messages showing that on cases of athlete misconduct, he was personally involved in trying to keep them out of the school's judicial affairs system, helping them get an attorney, addressing other issues like, you know, getting the cops to talk to them, getting the apartment complex supervisor to give them a heads up next time. So, you know, clearly there, and the other thing that we address in our book in Violated is that there was no random drug testing policy going on. So there are a lot of things in addition to the sexual assaults that happened under his watch. And yeah, he definitely left amid quite a bit of trouble.
Your book, Violated, gives us a narrative, a TikTok of some horrible sexual assaults that happened to young women at Baylor University. The lack of police investigation and the Baylor University taking these allegations serious, investigations serious. This had been coming out in newspapers. You guys have been covering it at ESPN. Hasn't this story been told? What more do we need to know?
Well, I think there's a lot more in the book that hasn't been told previously in the media. I mean, most importantly, we had 8 or 9 courageous women come forward and let us tell their stories, and a lot of them have remained silent until now. Jasmine Hernandez, who was the first woman to file a federal Title IX lawsuit against Baylor, her story's been out there, but she shared much more specific details with us. We talked to a woman who says she was gang raped twice in 2 separate incidents by Baylor football players who previously hadn't talked to anybody. We talked to Baylor regents, 4 or 5 of them. Talked to administrators and former administrators who gave us a good narrative of the inner workings of Baylor and what was going on behind the scenes to try to get a handle on this, and then how they dealt with the aftermath of it and Pepper Hamilton. And so there's a lot in the book that hasn't previously been reported.
Yeah, and I think it's, even if you don't care anything about Baylor University, if you've never even heard of Waco, Texas, it's still a story that should be read, because, I mean, we take you in the room where this stuff is happening, where these women say that they were assaulted, and through their incident, through their reporting, through the difficulties they faced in getting someone to take action and help them, and then the response that they got from the people who were supposed to be the ones to give them the counseling and the services, and how they failed them all along the way. And as I've told people in other interviews, it's just really a story about what happens when people in power ignore those in pain.
Baylor University wanted to become the Baptist version of Notre Dame, which was famous for its academic rigor and football. And they set out on a course to do that, and hiring Art Briles as a football coach. Why was that a major step in that direction?
Well, at the same time Baylor's long downtrodden football program was ascending, they were also trying to become one of the upper tier universities in the U.S. They wanted to be on par with the likes of the Ivy League institutions, Vanderbilt, and other schools, and be transformed from this regional denominational Christian university into a nationally recognized research institution that would attract star students from across the country, researchers, and federal grants that would really increase the academic rigor and reputation of the university. I think it was, what, Paul, a $2 billion endowment?
Yeah.
They were trying to establish a $2 billion endowment. And history has shown, and statistics show, that when your front porch, your athletics department, is successful, that tends to lead to increased enrollment, increased giving by alumni, increased ticket sales, and all that happened at Baylor. And Baylor had long been one of the worst programs in not only the Big 12, but in all of college football, and suddenly they were winning, and Art Briles led them to back-to-back shares of Big 12 championships, and they built a new stadium on the Brazos River, and things were good.
Ken Starr met Art Briles, asked him what he needed. He said a stadium on campus. Why is that significant?
Well, again, it was significant to the fact that they look at athletics as being the front porch of the university, and this was a case where the president was going to spare no expense in making sure that front porch was as attractive and as prominent and as big as possible. I mean, it was sort of a clear indication, a very tangible indication, that whatever the athletic department wanted, especially football, it was going to get. I mean, there's that example with the stadium. There's also the example when Tevin Elliott, one of the players who would go on to be convicted of sexual assault, was on academic probation. Briles went directly to Starr and asked him to intervene to be able to keep him eligible for the team, and he did.
Intervene? Tell me more.
He'd been caught plagiarizing and was supposed to be suspended for the fall semester of 2011. And he had missed the appeal deadline. And several weeks after that deadline, Art Briles intervened on Tevin Elliott's behalf and went straight to Ken Starr, who not only accepted an appeal that appeared to be written by a counselor or someone else, but he also granted the appeal and put Baylor's athletics department in charge of overseeing Elliott's probation instead of student affairs or student judiciary, which had typically done it for other students. And throughout his probation, there were other missteps academically and off the field, and nothing was ever done to him.
And so this was Tevin Elliott's second plagiarism accusation, right?
Correct.
Are we reading too much into that to say that this was telegraphing to Tevin Elliott that he could live by a separate set of rules?
Well, I think that was the message to all football players at Baylor. I mean, as Paula said with the drug testing, 99% of the FBS programs in the country had an internal drug testing system in place, and Baylor did not. And the regents we talked to told us that they believed the lack of drug testing contributed to Baylor bringing in quote, bad guys and creating a rotten culture within the locker room, and also giving these kids a heightened sense of entitlement that the rules didn't apply to them and they were above the law. Baylor players were tested by the NCAA and the Big 12 at championship events, but they were not tested randomly by Baylor officials, which is what happens at other schools.
Baylor University had a student code of conduct. Misconduct could get you expelled for pornography, drinking, all sorts of stuff. Dancing wasn't allowed on campus until 1996. This code of conduct was supposed to apply to players as well?
Oh, yeah. It was supposed to apply to all students. And, you know, the way it worked in these cases, and one thing we point out often in violated, is that the female students were so afraid of coming, violating the drinking rules, because they knew that drinking was not tolerated on campus, that students could be expelled for drinking, that would actually prevent them from reporting incidents of sexual assault. And there are women in, there's a woman in a lawsuit who says that when she went to Judicial Affairs to report being raped, that the Judicial Affairs Office took more interest in the fact that she was drinking. And we spoke to, I think it was the former Title IX coordinator and a sexual assault nurse, who talked about how women, instead of coming back to their dorms if they got intoxicated at a party, they would stay at the party, creating a ripe situation for a sexual assault, because they were afraid of running into campus security at the dorms and getting in trouble. So these student conduct rules, which, you know, were designed, I guess, to keep students in line, in this case, really worked against women coming forward and reporting sexual assaults and feeling like they could be taken seriously.
So that sexual assault nurse, is that Michelle Davis?
Yes.
She comes out as one of the few heroes in this book.
She really does. I think a lot of times people ask me, you know, who are the heroes in this book? And her name is one of the ones that comes to the top. And I like her because she's really kind of a neutral party here. You know, she didn't work for the university. She, you know, wasn't part of the athletic department. She was, I guess, the closest thing you could come in this whole thing to being sort of a neutral third party. And she was also the first line in reporting. I mean, as we point out, in violated women, they might not report their assault to the cops. They might not report it to the school, but they're going to go get checked out because they're worried about an STD, or they want to get a pregnancy test, or they want to, you know. And so she got a lot of information that other people didn't get. And what she says about these incidents and about what happens, I think people really need to take to heart.
She was on duty the night that Jasmine Hernandez came in after she was sexually assaulted by Tevin Elliott.
She recalls Jasmine being very angry. Told her what had happened, that she had been picked up and carried and taken to a muddy slope and sexually assaulted once, and then taken to a pool area and sexually assaulted again. And she examined her. She found, I don't want to get too graphic on here, but she found evidence that she thought would indicate that there was a forced sexual act and not something that happened that was consensual.
So, yeah, but the book does go into those details. Why do you think it's important to have it in the book, that people really see how brutal it was?
I think it's important to, you know, her story isn't even the most graphic. There's another story in there about a former Baylor student named Jennifer, who describes two alleged gang rapes by football players. And I mean, we do try to put you right in the room with her to sort of show how this incident built and how it came about that she was in this bathroom with all of these guys. I think it's really important because the thing that has frustrated me so much on social media is seeing people saying, well, you know, these women were asking for it, or they lied, or they just want to, you know, they just want the fame and notoriety of this. I mean, if you take these women's stories and you see what, and you go along with what happened, and then you also follow them through with all of the anxiety and the mental stress and the failed classes and the fractured relationships and the anxiety medications that they have to take after this, it's like, it's hard to say, you know, why would someone go to that extreme to do something. I mean, these women were clearly in pain, and I think showing the whole narrative, I think, is so important, because it's so easy to dismiss something in a tweet.
There was a lot of backlash and lack of cooperation, absence of sympathy from the university and from the Waco Police Department when these women came forward. When Jasmine Hernandez tried to report that she was raped by Tevin Elliott, what happened with the Waco police?
Her mother flew to Waco from California, and they went to Baylor's police department to report the crime, and the police basically told them that they couldn't do anything and that she had to go to Waco police because it happened off campus. Candace Hernandez, her mother, said they didn't even write down the alleged perpetrator, Tevin Elliott's name. She did say that the Waco Police Department was more cooperative and that the detective was sympathetic and said all the right things. But, you know, there were other issues. When she tried to get counseling for her daughter, she was told that that counseling sessions weren't available. She could register for the next semester, and said that her problems were probably too serious and she needed to go somewhere off campus to get the help she needed. When her mother called for academic assistance, she was told that the lady said, if a plane falls on your daughter, there's nothing we can do.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. We're speaking with ESPN reporters Paula Levine and Mark Schlabel about their new book, Violated, Exposing Rape at Baylor University Amid College Football's Sexual Assault Crisis.
There are federal laws that spell out what a university is supposed to do with a victim of sexual assault, right?
Yes, that is true. Title IX is the law in reference, and it requires universities to promptly investigate allegations of sexual violence, provide the person complaining, who's often a woman, not always, but often, resources to make her feel safe on campus, make her be able to continue her classes. And under the Obama administration, the U.S. Department of Education was pretty aggressive in putting that message out and in investigating the complaints then that would come into them when people said universities weren't doing this. Now, this is a real issue right now under the new education secretary, Betsy DeVos. There's been a lot of speculation about where she stands on Title IX and a real debate as to whether or not Title IX should even apply to sexual violence. And I think a lot of people are watching her administration to see where she's going to come down on that. I think there's a lot of misunderstanding out there about Title IX and about how it works, and it's somewhat disturbing to people who are watching this issue that all of the information isn't considered before they start making decisions on what to do and what to require universities to do or not to do.
But universities received this Dear Colleague letter in April of 2011.
Yeah, April 2011, universities received what's known as the Dear Colleague letter from the Office for Civil Rights within the U.S. Department of Education. The Dear Colleague letter was very explicit in saying that you have to act quick on these things in terms of responding. You have to act quickly to respond to the people who complain. You should not wait for a criminal investigation. And I still see universities doing that you should make sure that the person who complains, the complainant, has counseling service, has academic services, is able to switch classes if needed, has a campus escort if needed, is able to feel safe on campus. And then and there should be a formal procedure for adjudicating the case. And the universities across the country have struggled with that. The interesting thing is that even in cases where the complainant, the woman generally, prevails, there's still quite a bit of frustration about the process. Like, I think anyone will admit that the Title IX process that universities are using to investigate these cases is far from perfect. But it's still a necessary one. It's one that I think universities need to keep working on, because it's incredibly valuable for them to address this, because if they don't, if you look at the statistics out there, 1 in 5 women will report being sexually assaulted during college. I mean, that's a huge segment of your population.
One of the critical parts of Title IX is protecting victims from retaliation. Did it seem like the university was following that part of Title IX?
No, I mean, there were specific incidents where the victim in the Sam Ukwuachi incident, who was a former Baylor women's soccer player, said she encountered Ukwuachi on campus, would have to duck behind Coke machines and concession areas and things like that to avoid him. There was another woman, I believe it was Jennifer, who was the gang rape victim, who said she was ridiculed and harassed by friends of football players and those sorts of things. So
there was another case where a woman who allegedly reported a sexual assault involving a football player ended up being essentially reassigned out of her academic program. It's a little more complex than that, but that was sort of seen almost as a retaliatory act. Like she was, you know, the burden was on her to separate from the alleged assailant.
There was another incident where a woman had alleged domestic violence by her boyfriend, who was a football player, and her father actually wrote a letter to somebody at Baylor in the administration, and they responded by saying, "For your daughter's safety, get her off campus."
Tevin Elliott does go on trial for the rape of Jasmine Hernandez, and there's a couple of things here that the dancing testimony. Tevin Elliott and a couple of his friends testified that Jasmine Hernandez danced with him that night in a very provocative manner, and then she says that never happened. That seems really kind of out there that either she danced with him or she didn't. And that's either there was a conspiracy to cover it up or there wasn't.
Well, Jasmine has stuck with her story on that. She has said that she did not dance with Tevin. I believe her friends said they don't recall her ever dancing with Tevin, but you are correct. Tevin and his brother, and I believe his friend or roommate or teammate, said that they saw her dancing with him. I mean, that is a prime example of the he said, she said nature of this. I guess there's no other light to shed on that from the trial or from any of the interviews other than both sides still vehemently believe their position.
There was this video that surfaced during the trial that was bizarre.
Yeah, he had a video from his BlackBerry, which he said was a video of him carrying Jasmine away from the party back behind the pool house. And Hillary Laborde, assistant district attorney in Waco, instead told us that his attorney had hinted that he had video that cleared him and proved that Jasmine had consented and was vocally into it. And she said when she finally saw the video, she was upset that she'd been concerned about it because it was obvious that it wasn't Jasmine on the video, and she wasn't even sure that it was video of two people.
Right. I mean, I've seen the video. You don't see any person, right?
So is the narrative here that Baylor University made a deal with the devil in order to become a tier one great football program, win at any cost became the mantra, and they were willing to take football players and who otherwise would have gotten trouble at another university? Is that the story?
I don't know that you can say they cut a deal with the devil, but I can certainly see where you can say they cut some corners. I think by all accounts, they did not do a good enough job in vetting transfer students. I think once Baylor started to win at unprecedented heights that they'd never experienced before, Art Briles was given complete control of the program and was able to accept transfer players like Sam Ukwuachu, Sean Oakman, who'd been dismissed at Penn State for an incident with a woman there, a store clerk, and he is now facing sexual assault charges. I just think Art Briles had complete control over the program and was able to go straight to trustees and straight to Ken Starr and kind of circumvent the pecking order of authority, and that's what led to their downfall.
Yeah. And you had a school that overall was trying to improve its image and its notoriety and also maintain its Christian beliefs and its Christian ties, and there was a real issue about even acknowledging sexual assault as a problem. Women we talked to who said they were forced to come to these weekly sort of chapel discussions about, you know, quote-unquote social ills, said they would talk about pornography and cheating and dishonesty and in general, but never sexual assault. And I think on the campus, the bigger campus, even outside of football, I just think that there was such a belief that, well, we are this good Christian university, this sort of stuff doesn't happen here, was just sort of sticking their head in the sands to, well, yes, it is happening and you're not acknowledging it.
So Baylor University wanted to show the world that you could have an unapologetic Christian university and be a great university. Are they unapologetic? Have they ever apologized to any of these victims?
Yeah, they have. I mean, they have apologized. They've apologized in several statements that they have made. You know, in terms of issuing specific individual policies to some of the women, you know, I'm not exactly sure how that has happened, but I know in statements they even recently, in response to when Violated came out, they put something out saying that, you know, we're very sorry for anyone who's been harmed by in connection with this. You know, they have. I mean, I will say this. You know, Baylor, unlike some other universities, has acknowledged that it has done wrong. It has put information out there. I mean, it did commission the Pepper Hamilton investigation. When it came out with its findings of fact, they were really criticized for not being more specific. But you didn't have to read very far in that to see the university admit, like, we completely failed. That's one thing that, you know, in all honestly, I don't think Baylor gets enough credit for, is admitting that they did something, that they completely failed, that they failed Title IX, that they failed these women. You know, you can criticize them for not being as transparent as you think they should be in terms of saying exactly who, what, where, when, but they have overtly acknowledged that this happened and that they did wrong.
If you had a daughter ready to go off to college, or a son, would you have any qualms about sending them to Baylor?
I have two daughters about to go to college. Both of them are in high school, not too much younger than the women we talked to in this book. And the only thing I'll say is I told my wife they're not going to read it now, but about a week before they go off to college, they're going to sit down and read the book. And I can promise you that I will take a hard look at any institution they want to consider in the terms of what kind of Title IX programs they have in place and student judiciary and what the sexual assault rates are and things like that. And I think this is a book for every parent out there. I think it's a cautionary tale about what can happen, and we have to teach our daughters to make smart decisions and put themselves in the right positions to be safe. And we've got to do a better job, most importantly, of teaching our sons that no means no.
And Paula?
Yeah, my children are far from going to college, but I would agree. I think that. One thing I always joke is that not just for Baylor, I mean, we've been doing these stories on all campuses all over the country. And in my attic, I have boxes of police reports. And at some point in time, when they get to be older, I'm going to say, you guys need to read these. And I have a son and a daughter. And, you know that this goes on, know what not to do, know how to keep yourself safe. And also, I think a message that's really important that I would tell them wherever they decide to go is, you know, if you see something like this happening, you need to intervene. And I think that's a message that we need to give to all college students, anyone on a college campus, that, you know, it's not just about you. It's not just about your behavior. It's about watching out for your friends and contributing to the overall betterment of Baylor. I mean, I think the onus is on all Baylor students and students at campuses across the country that, you know, you're all a part of the solution here. You know, you need to read this book and understand what you can do, because it's not just up to the administration, it's not just up to the coaches, it's not just up to your parents, it's up to you, and you can make a difference. You can intervene, you can tell someone to stop it, you can be the role model.
Paula Levine and Mark Schlabel are reporters for ESPN. They have co-authored the book Violated, Exposing Rape at Baylor University Amid College Football's Sexual Assault Crisis. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write on our show page on our website at tpr.org. And that's where you can listen to past Texas Matters programs, and you can find us on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.